Robin Hood Radio and the Robin Hood Radio Network is proud to present Leonard Lopate at Large, lively hour-long in-depth discussions providing overviews and context to topics usually covered in partial measures. His guests include leading thinkers, scientists, artists, economists, farmers, historians, authors, and politicians. Mr. Lopate is a Peabody Award winner whose numerous honors include 3 Associated Press Awards and 3 James Beard Awards.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. The Brink is a fly-on-the-wall documentary about Stephen K. Bannon, the controversial conservative activist, filmmaker, former Breitbart head, and on-again, off-again advisor to President Trump. It's directed by Allison Clayman, who was able to get what's being described as unprecedented access to Bannon after he left his position at the White House in August 2017, less than a week after the Charlottesville Unite the Right rally. And it tracks Bannon's activities overseas, particularly his efforts to mobilize and unify far-right parties in order to win seats in the May 2019 European parliamentary elections. It opens this coming Friday, March 29th, at the IFC Center in Greenwich Village and at the Landmark 57 West. And it brings Allison Clayman and the film's producer, Marie-Thérèse Guirguis, to our show now. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Since this film is so revealing, I couldn't help but wonder why Bannon granted you all the access to his activities during the 15 months you filmed him. Is it because, as he says in the film, Trump taught me a great lesson, there's no bad media?
I think that's definitely a part of it, and that's why it's important to acknowledge that in the film, to let the audience know that I am fully aware that as it shows in the film, he is very media savvy. He spends a lot of his time working the press, fostering relationships, being a source on and off the record. But I think, you know, part of why he let this project go forward, and it definitely wasn't easy, was also, you know, a previous relationship he had with Marie-Thérèse, which she can talk about, and, you know, that he's someone that you can really play into his vanity.
He says that the mainstream media is his biggest ally. But do you think he was completely unaware of how much of what you filmed could be seen as embarrassing to him? There are moments when he curses unnecessarily, when he puts down people who work for him in ways that seem rather high-handed.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, the Verite or Cinema Verite-style documentary, I think the strength of it is the long time that the filmmaker, you know, in this case, that I could spend watching him, observing him, to really figure out what is performance and what are all the ranges of performance, because, you know, we all kind of perform for people in different settings, and, you know, he is very much in that vein. I don't even know if he was, you know, there are some moments that feel like he's taking off the mask when he's alone, but, you know, I think being around allows you not only to calibrate what they're doing, but also to let them forget that you're really there.
He lets his guard down.
Yeah, he said to me towards the end of shooting, actually, I think when Allison was editing, and I was still, you know, talking to him about various things, he said a couple of times, he said, oh God, how many hours does she have? How many hours of footage does she have? I swear I forgot she was there sometimes. I really forgot she was there sometimes. And I think that's it's a testament to Allison and her savvy and her ability to navigate being in that world. And
well,
being
was
with
anything
him.
Off limits? Did he ever say, I really don't want you here for this meeting?
For sure, things were off limits. And I try to do things in the film also to, like, let the audience know that, you know, show a few times when I was invited to leave the room. He would always do it in a very particular way, though. He wouldn't say, okay, like, now please leave, or, you know, you got to get out. It was always, did you get everything you need? You got everything you need? That was, like, his way. But usually it was when meetings were going to be talking about things like money. Also, when he was meeting with people who didn't agree to be filmed. I mean, once he was on board, you know, he was pretty on board. But, you know, every day, the point of the film is to watch how he operates and who he works with, and not everybody is willing to participate.
Were you're a one-person crew?
Yeah, I think that's the best way to get this kind of intimate access, so it was just me and my fanny pack and the camera.
Marie-Thérèse, I read that the movie first came about when you reached out to Bannon about the possibility of making a documentary about him. But you knew him because you'd worked with him in the 2000s at Wellspring Media, which mm-hmm. was one of his previous lives.
Yes, yes. He had put together a small group of people who bought the company that I worked for, Wellspring, which was an art house film distribution company that released mostly foreign language films, documentaries, some American independents.
And why do you think he was interested in that?
At the same time, he bought several other production and smaller distribution companies. I think that he always had the ambition to be in the movie business. You know, he worked in Hollywood. He was in Hollywood. I think that his intention was to try to build sort of a small studio. And, you know, he never gave up. I think in some ways he still hasn't given up being in the movie business.
One day also when it was announced that, like, I think it was New York Magazine was going to be up for sale or potentially was up for sale when I was filming, and he got really excited and he was making calls. I filmed all this of him being like, oh, we got to buy it. Like, we could buy it. So, you know, I think
he would have had to get somebody to give him the money, wouldn't he?
He's that's one of his strengths.
Yeah, that's not very difficult for him. Uh-huh. I think he's always been able to, you know, convince people to give him money to do things and buy things.
But he turned you down the first three times you asked.
Yeah.
Why do you think he agreed to your fourth request?
You know, Allison and I always say we will never know. I think that it was a combination of his vanity. You know, people have to remember that he was not a well-known figure until about 3 years ago. Nobody really knew who he was outside of far-right circles. And it's very appealing to him to be covered by even the journalists and the media that he claims to, you know, to despise. He actually really admires.
Oh, we see him wooing them.
Yes,
all the time.
I mean, because he also personally is very admiring and looks up to these kinds of figures and these kinds of organizations. So I think A, there was the vanity, the prestige of the film. B, I think he was around the end of April, early May in the White House. He was still in the White House. I'm sure, based on what we know now, things were probably, you know, going south. And so he probably thought, what do I have to lose? And I think C, you know, what Allison said earlier, what, you know, even bad media might be good media in his mind. Although I don't think this film is quite the film he maybe envisioned when he thought of bad media.
Could it have been made if he hadn't agreed to sign a release relinquishing control of his appearances in the final cut?
No.
No, well, we would never. I mean, most of that, the agreement that we reached was our terms, which was that he had no creative control. Really where he has control is he can say, you know, like I said, you know, you got everything you need. He can, you know, make it so that I am not welcome to film particular things.
Although since he's made films that have very strong positions, he's directed a number of movies about people he promoted as Republican heroes and also others in which he painted Democrats villains. He must have wondered whether you were going to make him look bad.
Yeah, but I think what I believe is that the way he expected to look bad, because I certainly reminded him all along the way that the film would most likely be, it was not going to be particularly flattering. It was very important to me that he understood where I was coming from and that everything was transparent. But I think that he's expected the kind of villainous depiction that already exists of him in the media. And one of the reasons I wanted to make the film was because I actually think that that depiction is very empowering. I think it is not a negative for somebody like Steve. I think it's actually a source of strength and power. So I think the way the film sort of deconstructs him is actually a particularly unflattering way that he's not used to.
He also agreed to make another film with Errol Morris, which is quite different. That's an extended interview. This, I'm sure he felt he could control a bit more because he is the central figure. Has he seen the completed film?
The Brink?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yours.
He saw the film just before it premiered at Sundance this January, and Marie-Thérèse actually showed it to him.
And did he tell you anything about it, what he thought?
I think he played his cards pretty close to the vest, but. And, you know, he didn't really acknowledge whether he was hated it or loved it. But shortly after the review started coming out, he cut me off completely and stopped talking to me. So it's pretty clear to me what he thinks of the movie.
He's alleged to have been the architect of President Trump's both sides comments following the Unite the Right march in Charlottesville, Virginia. Do you think that he felt liberated after he no longer held an official position in the Trump administration? Because he says, I hated every second of the time I was a senior advisor.
That's something I definitely believe that he said. I don't think he likes to have to operate within particular confines of how, you know, the position of being in, that he had being in the White House, there's actual rules. And like, he wasn't the final say, you know, I mean, not only did Trump overrule him, but, you know, he couldn't be the one, even though people like to act like he was entirely pulling the strings. I don't think that was the case. And I think for him being in control of Breitbart News, of kind of his building his own persona and choosing where he wants to go and how to operate is a much more preferable position to be in.
Although I will say I think he regretted not being as close to power. I do think there was part of him that, you know, still had a this kind of resentment and sort of a little bit of, I don't know if longing is the right word, but.
Well, I think this year is sort of him trying to solidify himself as an ally to Trump outside the White House, but very much an independent entity and continuing to build his profile, you know, globally. But also, I think, I mean, it really is an exercise in messaging. And it's about, you know, he's creating these terms, economic nationalism and populism. And he's really, and his activities in Europe. And he's really trying to get the mainstream media to write about it as if it matters and to use his definitions as if they are the default meanings of what he's doing.
He remains a strong supporter of the president, even after Trump calls him Sloppy Steve. That's in the film. And there are other things that Trump said, negative things that he said about him over the years.
Don't you find that curious? I found it very curious that for the entire 13 months that I was filming him, I felt like the one thing he seemed to stay on message on was that he would not say anything bad about Trump, even though it seemed very clear that he had other thoughts.
Well, he's not dumb. That's his base. I mean, Bannon doesn't have his own base. He does not. He's not on social media. He does not have followers.
Although he had adoring audiences throughout this.
Yeah, film. But I would say that most of the people that are there because he's a surrogate for Trump, which he was.
And they know him from from talk radio.
Yeah, and he's a celebrity in that world, but he needs Trump as much as he might resent that.
Now, he campaigned for the Alabama senatorial candidate, Roy Moore. Mm-hmm. Who was charged with all sorts of embarrassing indiscretions. Did that put him on the outs with some of the Republican higher-ups? Did they begin to see him as a liability?
I think that felt like the shine of, you know, he knows something that we don't know, right? Because I think that he came in late to the Trump campaign and probably advised certain steps that most people would not. For example, after the Billy Bush tape that came out, the Access Hollywood tape, you know, he sort of advocated for zero remorse and kind of going forward, and that worked. And so, you know, the idea that he had the Midas touch, I think, was vanquished once he backs Roy Moore again unapologetically and manages to lose a Republican seat in the Senate, in a very historical fashion. But
the president also supported Roy Moore.
Well,
after he supported his opponents in the primary.
Exactly. And I think because, you know, they just kind of had to, because I think this is maybe a different point, but it's important to remember Bannon is not a fringe element of the Republican Party. Bannon is the Republican Party, you know, as he was supporting Roy Moore and a lot of his activities in fall of 2017, which you see in the film, he's talking a big game about going against the Republican establishment. But from the inside vantage point that we had, that was really laughable. He's on the phone with Lindsey Graham, Jeff Sessions. I mean, the Republican Party was either directly working with him at every given moment, or they were countenancing, you know, what he was doing because they hoped it would win.
Yes.
So why did he decide to turn to Europe and work to establish a network of right-wing leaders across the continent, leaders who appear to be quite eager for him to help them plan their takeover and make changes to their respective governments?
I think to some degree, this is also a story of Bannon's, you know, search for increased or growing or perhaps recovered, depending how you look at it, relevance. And I do think the fact that he was articulating, you know, in 2017, this vision for a global far-right you know, unified movement, you know, both uniting Europe, which is a particular project, the far right parties of Europe, but also just talking about it globally, I do think is one of the reasons that Bannon was a figure that we felt was worth following. On the other hand, I think there's definitely a personal dimension to it as well, which is he wants to be a power broker. And the fact that, you know, again, his proximity to Trump, previous proximity to Trump, made him someone who, you know, could go around the world and be seen as like a celeb.
Yeah, not just the proximity, but the go back to the notion of how the media built him up. Mm-hmm. He was built up as a mastermind, as a genius strategist. So that's a very powerful thing to take overseas.
I'm speaking with Marie-Thérèse Guergues, producer of a new film called The Brink, and Alison Clayman, who is the director, the cinematographer, the sound engineer. Did you edit it as well?
I did some editing, and we, along with our two editors, it was only possible once I stopped filming, which was, you know, the day after the midterms.
And this is Let It Lopate at Large on WBAI, New York 99.5 FM. You show him wining and dining European nationalist leaders as he's launching what you mentioned, what he calls the movement, his the name he's given to the alt-right supergroup he's forming in Europe. And he sees this as a kind of a centralized source for far-right ideas and strategies?
Yeah, well, you know, it actually starts as a foundation that is registered, I believe, in Brussels by a leader of a small far-right party called the People's Party in Belgium, a pretty insignificant one in terms of Belgian politics. But this guy, Michael Madrikamen, is such a fan of Trump. He even would make these videos supporting Trump along the way while he was running for president and when he won. He says right afterwards he launched this, or he filed to create this entity because that was a word in Trump's speech, maybe his inauguration speech, about being, you know, it being a movement. And he was very excited that Bannon, who had been ignoring his communication, I think, for around a year, finally, you know, was there in Europe, and they were meeting. And you see some in the film, their first, you know, footage from their first meeting. These are real closed door first time meetings between these people. And, you know, he is sort of saying, maybe we could use this. It's sort of a shell right now. And Bannon was like, great, we're going to do this. We're going to make this a convening authority. We're going to do data analytics and polling, a lot of stuff that hasn't necessarily materialized yet. But this was, you know, what they were trying to imagine when they first met in the summer of 2018.
And I don't remember reading very much about these activities while he was engaged in it. I think we learned an awful lot about it just from seeing this film. But do you think that the Republican establishment back home was aware of what he was doing?
There's a Republican congressman in,
yeah,
in the film.
There's a sitting them. Republican congressman who's at one of these, you know, first dinners, Republican Paul Gosar. He is known now in the kind of on the U.S. stage for, now remember, he won his reelection in the 2018 midterms, but all five of his siblings participated in a campaign ad against him for his opponent. But yeah, he's sitting there with these various far-right leaders who are talking about how, you know, it would be great. We know that Trump can't support us, but, you know, it'd be great to have some, you know, senators and congressmen here. To me, I felt like this, I mean, I personally felt like, I was like, this meeting seems really inappropriate. It feels like it's like they're, you know, Bannon says to them as well, you got to remember, we run the government. What can we do for you? Which, again, could be seen as just a conversation. But I felt like, you know, he's not even in the White House. What does he mean? You know, what can we do for you? Who is he implying, if not actually going to then go and call and talk about these needs? But I think it's something also really spiritual that was happening there, too. It's that these parties kept saying to him, it's no joke, they kept saying, you know, the fact that you're here and you're giving these speeches, the fact that Trump says things, or, you know, earlier that week he had said at a press conference in the UK that, you know, immigration was destroying the cultural fabric of Europe. They're like, when you guys say these things, it makes us feel like we're not alone. And I think that, you know, that is something that is really frightening, is really frightening to watch, because I think no matter what, whether he's actually getting them money, giving them data help, giving them, you know, polling help. I think he's giving them a spiritual, you know, boost that is going to keep them going. You know, these elections are decided by very few people coming out to vote and very slim margins. So
I also have no doubt that Bannon is in conversation with people in the White House, in the administration. I think he had a hand in appointing a number of these people. If we remember, he was one of the key people who appointed a number of them. And when you see, you know, Bannon officially sign on somebody like Bolsonaro, and then a month later, Bolsonaro is in the White House with Trump, I don't think it's a coincidence.
He also meets with Nigel Farage in the UK, the leaders of the National Rally in France, Fidesz in Hungary, and other nativist parties in Europe. And he must be thrilled that there seems to be this real turn to the right through much of Europe. He can't take credit for it.
No, he does take credit for it.
He does take credit, but you're absolutely right that he can't credibly take credit, although he is.
Yeah, he does. And he will continue to, as long as journalists, I think, keep
allowing
him to say it in interviews.
And that's the thing that's really frustrating, because you say, you know, maybe like a lot of people, you know, who once this movie, you know, it stopped being a secret project and I let it know, and I have had a lot of people who are like, I didn't know Bannon was still like doing anything, because if you're not obsessively following him, you might not know. But if you are, and you, or even, you know, we have a Google alert for Steve Bannon, and every day the number of political articles, whether it's, you know, from mainstream, you know, centrist to left media globally, that are just built around what he's saying or what he thinks. It's like, this is what he thinks of Brexit. This is what he thinks of the Mueller report. This is what,
like the Yahoo article yesterday. You don't feel that there's a real intermediator. They're quoting him because it's clickbait, honestly. Mm-hmm. The more sensational things that he says. I mean, talk about what the Spanish journalist said to you the other day, Allison.
Yeah, and we just came back from the
film. You wish you're still filming? I'm getting the feeling.
No. I'm very happy to be done filming.
Okay, anyways.
But I am excited to be talking about it, because I think these things are, you know, I think part of why we, you know, I put the camera down in November. We premiered the film in January, and it's in theaters now. And there's a reason we always knew we were going to be on this trajectory, is that it feels very urgent, right? And just to say, we just came back from the film's international premiere, and I did some interviews with journalists from different countries in Europe, and an El País journalist was saying to me, it's the exact same thing. They have a far-right party there called Vox. I didn't film any of those representatives for this project, but I know that Vox, quote unquote, officially signed on to, you know, Bannon's the movement. And he said, you know, we have exactly this problem that, you know, whenever we write about Vox, or especially if we write about Bannon and Vox are together, we get lots and lots of clicks. And that's the model of journalism. We need advertising. You know, that's how we can pay for what we do. But they don't like it. And they're all trying to figure out how they can get around it, because, frankly, they're not trying to boost the electoral prospects of this far right party either.
I think it's one of the biggest dilemmas of our day is how journalists approach figures like Bannon and other far right figures.
Well, Donald Trump would not have become president
if
people who he calls the enemies of the people hadn't written about it.
That was really one of the motivations for making the film. That living through that and watching that happen, as someone who knew Bannon personally.
We see him in Europe and then back in the United States, going from town to town, giving speeches about Christian values and working class frustrations. Before what appear to be adoring audiences. Did he just keep on flying back and forth?
Yeah.
So how can he afford that? Because he doesn't look like he's sitting with the rest of the common folk. Private planes and first class?
Oh, yeah. I never flew on a private plane before this project. And then that was, you know, a lot of what I was doing, because I was riding alongside. You know, I think that the number of billionaires that are featured in this film and the number of private plane rides and five-star hotels, it's not just like an easy dig, you know, oh, the contradiction of populism versus he lives a luxurious lifestyle as he frankly like keeps an insanely difficult work schedule doing all these things. But it's absolutely meant to raise the question that you just did. I mean, this is not a movement funded from the little guy that he professes to be out for. And so fundamentally, he is funded by billionaire interests. He loses the backing of Robert and Rebecca Mercer around the time of Michael Wolff's book, Fire and Fury, coming out. And he had a very public sort of falling out with the president. But there's no shortage of millionaires and billionaires that you see in the film and people's money that he's able to take. And I think that that speaks volumes for who he's carrying water for this movement.
And his own values, his own personal values.
But he also says he doesn't take money from foreign interests, but we know that he's taking money from a Chinese billionaire who is used to be close to the Chinese leadership and is now considered an enemy of the state, who lives in the United States. What does he hope to get out of Bannon?
It's a good question. I mean, he initially, Miles Kwok or Guo Wengui and Bannon, you know, he came onto Bannon's radar because when Donald Trump was elected, according to Bannon, all these different, you know, prominent business people from around the U.S. who did work business in China were coming to the, you know, upcoming new administration, people like Bannon, and saying, it'd be great if you could do this one thing, you know, the number one thing that, you know, my partners in China or people in China want. They want you to extradite Miles Kwok because the government, you know, had it out for him so bad. He's kind of going around acting like he is a whistleblower. I think that's not really it.
He's a member of Mar-a-Lago.
Yeah, totally. but he is sort of saying, I was in the inside, I know all the dirt, and he has YouTube videos, and he goes online and says he knows what's going on in the Communist Party and all the inside, you know, baseball. Bannon seems to buy it, which I think is ridiculous. I think that Kwok is probably also preying on the fact that Bannon has little to no expertise about any of these people. So anything he says, Bannon's like, oh, this is my guy. He knows the stuff. But I don't, you know, I think all you can tell from the interactions I filmed between them, you can tell that their relationship is at least deserves more scrutiny because they don't really, their conversations are very awkward. It seems like they clearly don't have like a personal rapport.
But Bannon was also at Goldman Sachs. Mm-hmm. And doesn't he get support from some of the people there? Do you know?
Well, I mean, John Thornton, who the former president of Goldman Sachs, is in our film and was with Bannon constantly and is constantly on the phone with him. I think Bannon is still close to a number of investment bankers.
He always talks about his hedge fund guys.
Whether he's getting actually financed by them, we don't have evidence of that. That appeared in our film. But I will say that he's certainly, for someone who, you know, rails against the elite, he's certainly, you know, working with high-level investment bankers.
And I think that also the other thing that people have to, like, think one step beyond what this kind of footage shows is that clearly, why are these people working with him? Well, clearly his, whatever changes he wants to bring to the world, they don't think threaten their wealth and they don't think threaten the status quo when it comes to what corporations and high net worth individuals get to do in the world.
Although you stick to a largely verite approach, following Bannon around, observing his various interactions, you also intercut some important context, like news reports on confessed bomber Cesar Savak, the Tree of Life synagogue shooting, and you also include footage of fascist rallies and Germans attacking migrants, along with scenes of these very fancy, very chummy dinners that Bannon has with right-wing European nationalist leaders. He couldn't have been happy that you were showing that side of what he, of the people who he's involved with.
Well, I think what's great about documentary is you get to create a work and provide the context within it. You know, again, when my daily mantra for working on this project was, let him be underestimating me and let me never underestimate him. I think I felt like it was important never to underestimate him, in part because what we were talking about earlier, that, you know, he is incredibly savvy, and one of his gifts is messaging, working the media. He doesn't sit down to an interview in good faith. You know, he's going to distort facts. He's going to change the topic. These are all things that I think if you're entering and trying to make a movie about him, you have to be incredibly aware of. But the idea of him underestimating me is in part, I think what that means is that I just hope that he couldn't imagine the film that I would make and, you know, what kind of context I would bring. Yes, I'm limited to truthfully or fairly presenting what I film, and it's not just, you know, a highlight reel of every time he says a curse word, or, you know, I don't chop up what he says to make, you know, or change the meaning of an interaction, because, you know, I wouldn't do that, and to anyone, let you know.
And you didn't need to do that, by the way.
But that's the point, is that, like, I think he maybe didn't realize that I didn't need to do that, and that I can provide the context, and the film is going to have a point of view. And I think he's used to being called evil or racist, but like Marie-Thérèse was saying earlier, you know, that doesn't bother him. That does not bother him. Yeah. Not because he's like, great, I'm a racist. It's because he doesn't think he's one, and he's able to go forward. But he's also kind of seen as like a dark arts villain, you know, which is very, very powerful. And I think a lot of what I was doing shows that, you know, he makes him smaller than life.
Yeah, and what you pointed out, I just was going to say that, you know, you said he must not like being seen with those people, but I actually disagree. I, you know, he famously said at a speech in France about being called a racist, you know, wear it as a badge of honor. And that doesn't mean that it's good to be a racist. It means that if the left is, basically, if the left is criticizing you as a racist, that means you're doing your job.
I want to address that in just a moment. You're listening to Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York. I'm speaking with the filmmakers responsible for a new documentary called The Brink.
He's a friend of mine.
Well, I have a very good relationship, as you know, with Steve Bannon.
He is not a racist, I can tell you that.
How did that turn into this?
In a blistering statement, the president said, Steve Bannon had nothing to do with me or my presidency. When he was fired, he not only lost his job, he lost his mind.
The bromance between two anti-establishment Republicans has turned into a bad breakup. It happened after these remarks by Steve Bannon came to light.
He's not going to make it, Bannon reportedly said. He's lost his stuff.
They're going to crack Don Jr. like an egg on national TV.
Treasonous and unpatriotic.
Bannon's comments in this book sparked the president's wrath and gave Bannon the nickname Sloppy Steve. Now, the Breitbart chairman, who once boasted about overthrowing the Republican establishment in a blazing revolution, is losing key conservative allies, a sign that his revolution may not be televised. The family of hedge fund billionaire Robert Mercer played a role in funding Bannon's platform, but not anymore.
We are back with the filmmakers responsible for The Brink, which opens at two theaters this Friday, the IFC Center on... can we say 6th Avenue? Or it has to be Avenue of the Americas?
6th Avenue. It's old
in
school
Greenwich
New York.
Village. And also the Landmark 57 West. Director, cinematographer, et cetera, Allison Clayman, and producer Marie-Thérèse Guirgis. And let's get into that whole business about racism and the like. When he discusses the movement, Bannon is repeatedly challenged about using fascist anti-Semitic rhetoric, and he insists that he's unaware of the dual or true meaning of that language and appears to be rebranding right-wing and what can be seen as anti-Semitic language as economic nationalism. Is he really that clueless?
Did you buy that?
No.
Yeah. I mean, that's how I feel. I feel like he's a grown man. He's intelligent enough. It's not enough to just say, oh, I don't know, and then to say, and I reject I reject that this is speaking to a certain group. I mean, you just don't get to do that.
Yeah, but you do get the feeling he's a bit clueless in the film's opening scene where he admires the architectural perfection of Auschwitz, and he screens a trailer as he's screening a trailer for his film Trump at War. He jokes, "I always ask, what would Leni Riefenstahl do?"
Well, I don't think he's clueless. I think he is a provocateur. I think he knows that things like that, lines like that, get attention. I early on, I saw his Reagan documentary. I was working for him when he showed me a cut of it, and I had to give notes on it. And I made a joke about Leni Riefenstahl. I said, oh, it's really the subtlety of this. It's just like Leni Riefenstahl. And he loved it. And from then on, he used that. And he likes things like that. He likes, you know, he calls himself a flamethrower. I don't think he's clueless. I agree with Allison. I think he knows exactly what he's doing.
He says he believes that propaganda, which he admits that film is by definition good. And then he brags about a scene shot at Auschwitz for Torchbearer, his film about the worldview of Duck Dynasty star Phil Robertson, which is as eye-opening in its own way as this film is.
Yeah.
But with a very different intent. And speaking of the concentration camps, Bannon appears to be uninterested in the evils they represent. He marvels instead at the precision German engineering at Birkenau and imagines the meetings in which it was designed.
I mean, what I found why that piece of tape where he's telling me this story and what he chooses to emphasize and how he talks about it, I think, you know, we put it at the front of the film for a lot of reasons. And I think, you know, one of them is fundamentally, he's not saying that the Holocaust was a good thing. He's saying it's a moral horror. You know, he's not denying that it even happened, which, to be honest, some people have such a disdain for him and think he's such a hateful figure that I do think it plays with audience expectations that they might expect he's just going to say, oh, you know, it's not so bad or it didn't happen. And that's absolutely not where he's coming from.
But he does say,
he
talks about how seemingly ordinary people can detach themselves from moral horror.
Well, exactly. Yeah. So to me, I still think what he is talking about is entirely creepy, and I personally found inappropriate. I think you could, the way it's, because the glee, the excitement that he derives from thinking about, you know, essentially the banality of evil and the expert architecture, like you said, of the whole system that was able to divorce itself, you know, and it's just people from corporations sitting in meetings, the good people back in Germany, quote unquote. To me, this was the very thematic question that I wanted to explore in following Steve Bannon in the first place. So when, you know, 8 months into the project, he ambles into this story, I was completely, you know, chilled to the bone inside. I felt like when he's talking about those cups of coffee in those meetings, I, in my head, was thinking, that's what all my footage is. I mean, my footage is, it might be Red Bull, and, you know, for some people he's sitting with in Europe, glasses of red wine, you know, but it's these meetings. What I worried about my verite, I think the film ends up coming off quite, you know, action-packed, but the raw material is like, you know, it's people sitting around in meetings. How do you convey what is so awful about it? And to me, the fact that he literally sets that up in the opening scene was really powerful.
But he also wants to present himself as a regular guy. He appears to love using the word dude to denote sincerity. He calls the Guardian reporter Paul Lewis dude when Lewis pushes him to acknowledge the anti-Semitic dog whistle in his George Soros references on the topic of immigration. And he also denies that he ever does dog whistles.
I had a long conversation with him on the phone about this very subject of dog whistles, and he seemed to be very serious. He was asking me quite seriously about it, and did I think he was using anti-Semitic language and dog whistles? And I said yes, and I explained why.
And me too.
And at the end of the conversation, I said to him, I said, look, you know, sometimes somebody tells me that something is offensive to them, and even if I don't understand right away why it is, I believe that person, and I stop saying whatever the term is or expression is, etc. So why would you just not stop because it hurts people? You have plenty of Jewish friends. If you know that something is hurtful, if you know that something is offensive, just stop. And the fact is, he could not reply to that.
But I do think it's a little more sinister than that, actually, that it's not just about he doesn't mind hurting the feelings of, let's say, Jews who find those words offensive. These are terms that mean something.
Oh, of course it's more sinister.
Right, to a group of people. It's not a coincidence that the New Zealand shooters, you know, manifesto is you know, filled with the same language that we're talking about in this film. It's about, you know, the way that Soros was behind the caravan, how, you know, how even Fox News would posit, or Trump would, you know, flat out say, how it's all about this, you know, invasion that's also being facilitated by Jews or, you know, the global elite in general.
Well, the Jews will not replace us,
right?
Was the chant of the marchers in Charlottesville.
Yeah, and all of this is talking about like Western civilization, the Judeo-Christian West or the Christian West.
The entire agenda of the movement is anti-Islam. That is the one theme that is loud and clear that has any kind of unifying force amongst all of those Europeans is a complete hatred of Islam and Islamic refugees and immigrants.
But isn't Bannon fond of opening his speeches by saying there's room for everyone in the Trump movement?
Sure, he's not
dumb. No matter their race, gender, or religion, even though he was pretty much the architect of the Muslim ban.
What's interesting to me, I mean, I just don't buy, I think that's rhetoric. I'm not even sure that it's worth taking it seriously. One time with me personally, he threw in the idea of, you know, gender identity, and if you're trans, you're welcome to. And at that point, I did interrupt him. I said, respectfully, no one in your movement is advocating for trans anything. And he said, that might be at the rear.
Trans people a place in the military.
And so I think that that is just plain rhetoric. And I think also...
And he's not the first to say it.
I think he really does see the world as, you know, and he says it a couple times in the film, talking about good guys or, you know, there is an idea of good guys and bad guys. And I don't necessarily think the judgment of if you're a good guy or a bad guy is your race or your, you know, or things like that. But I think it's whether you're with him or not. He gives that speech and he would say to me when we would argue about this kind of stuff, you know, he'd say, did you see that room, you know, of supporters on the Upper East Side of New York, which was a jam-packed hooting and hollering, you know, spectacle to see when he spoke to them. I mean, maybe Tracy, you were there. Mm-hmm. He said, you know, I say to that room or the, you know, or New Mexico, wherever, I always say, it doesn't matter your race, religion, da da da, you know, we're going to help the blacks and Hispanics. That's his words. And, you know, and those people are all cheering. They're not racist. I said, yeah, you're telling them that one day that there are people out there who are going to join your movement. You're saying one day these people will agree with the way you see the world. That's what they're cheering for. They're not cheering about helping, you know, helping other people or having a more inclusive vision of their movement. Well, what they're cheering for is one day you will see the world the way I do.
Well, they don't think they're racist either.
Yeah.
You know, very few people walk around declaring themselves racist.
Although he does talk about Christian values, and in one very revealing scene in your film, shot in the back seat of a black car that was traveling through London, mm-hmm. Bannon is told by a British staffer that a formerly Christian-heavy street has become populated with Arab stores, and Bannon asks, when did it flip?
Such a telling moment, right? That's exactly the kind of thing that I don't think he would have ever remembered that moment or thought that it would be revealing in the film. And I think that it's the same. It's how he talks about things. It's, you know, what he worries about. The idea that for a street to have Arab stores on it and a bank that says it's, you know, compliant with Sharia financing, that this is, you know, oh, God. I mean, it's bizarre. It shows something about the worldview, which is an anti-Islam fear of Islam invading and conquering. I think it's, you know, I think that it's the same as when you get in the room with him and these far right leaders and they're talking about birth rates of Islamic families versus native Belgian families. That's part of a conversation. I mean, that is blatantly a concern about an other coming in and diluting white European nation. Like,
I just want to add that he, at the same time, he's also working with and doing business with the Saudis, with the Emiratis. So, you know, he's very selective about the Arabs and the Muslims that he likes and doesn't like. I think there's a divide that has to do a lot with money.
And I've watched, again, with his message discipline. I did observe over this last year, I think, I actually know that someone suggested to him that he should talk about radical Islam. He used to just say Islam when he would be saying all these bad things. Now he tries to specify where he says radical Islam. But to me, this concern about birth rates or the idea that a street flipped and it's a shame that indicates that it's a disdain that comes from and fear that comes from a different place.
Oh yeah, and I'm Egyptian, and you know, I would always remind him because it was very upsetting to me as an Arab American.
Marie-Thérèse Girgis is an Egyptian name.
Yes, Girgis is a very Egyptian last name, and I would remind him all the time of it, and he would say, "Yes, but you're a Christian Egyptian." Mm.
So that was okay.
That was okay.
One writer suggested after watching your film that despite his reputation as a deep thinker and despite the history hardcover books that he always lugs around with him, you'd be hard-pressed to find any real ideology in his words. And what he does have are symbolic expressions, feelings posing as words and ideas. You're nodding your head.
It's great when reviewers and writers write things that make you feel seen as a filmmaker. Again, with Verite, I think that, you know, the movie doesn't just spontaneously make itself, right? While it's a direct cinema experience, there's a lot of choices at every juncture. And I think that it feels really good when people write things that I feel like, yeah, that's the conclusion that I reached after 13 months.
Your previous film was Ai Weiwei, Never Sorry, and I had the great pleasure of interviewing Ai Weiwei when that film came out.
I probably saw you on his Instagram.
That wasn't a Verite film, though.
It was Verite, but it had sit-down interviews, you know, that kind of rounded out some of the context, both about Weiwei's, you know, life, you know, from childhood on, important moments in his life, and Chinese history. I think that, I spent 3 years following him in a very similar manner where it was, you know, me and the camera. I wasn't using a monopod back then, but now I've switched to a monopod.
You could use your phone these days.
Yeah, I know, but it would be very shaky.
You'd
need stabilization. So I felt like that was one of my best sort of training. I mean, to me, it is Verite, but we did rely on interviews.
And I was surprised at how many of the scenes resonate. At one point, he and Sam Nunberg, who suddenly became famous after being totally unknown for...
After getting drunk on cable news for a whole day.
Mm-hmm. The Bannon and Nunberg discuss the border wall, and they basically concede that it's not a serious policy proposal, but just a simplistic concept that resonates with Republican voters.
So when you get a moment like that, to me that feels like, wow, they're really acknowledging something. It feels explosive, and then you take a step, and you take a beat. When I'm on the road filming, and I would also often get discouraged because I'd think I got the goods, mm-hmm. and then you also think, but everybody knows this already. And this to me was the most difficult sort of despair to deal with while I was filming this. Yes, I was listening to stuff I disagreed with pretty much all day, which was not pleasant and, you know, was challenging for me. And I did have opportunities to discuss and ask questions that you hear me a little bit in the film. I did spend more time talking, but,
He speaks directly to the camera a couple of times.
But the project wasn't really about, you know, Bannon's conversations with the camera woman behind the scenes or like about me trying to, you know, push back on him. It was about hearing them say things. So whenever they would say something that I thought was revealing that was not just revealing the cynicism. That's them, you know, shouting the cynicism of Trump and the Trump campaign and you know, all of the messaging that to the Trump voters. And it would just be so hard where I would think, but what does it matter if you get that on camera because, you know, people already kind of know?
But seeing it is a totally different story.
Yeah, and I think fundamentally, you know, you keep going every day because I do think that it has value. I think it's a historical document, and I also think it's an opportunity for people to have a conversation about it and not have to say, oh, this is like fake or this is, you know, somebody's opinion. This is literally, you know, the people who work on these messages talking about how empty they are.
Well, I think 10 to 15 years from now, as we're seeing this decade in perspective, this film is going to take on all sorts of other meanings for people.
Yeah,
because you've recorded stuff that, as you say, right now many people already take for granted, but it's one thing for them to say on some cable news network, this is the way things are. It's another thing to actually see these people, Sam Nunberg and Steve Bannon, saying these things.
To each other.
Yes. Yeah. And that was really the goal, was, what's the contribution that documentary film can make in this moment? I think it is pushing to be in the room, on the private jet, whatever it is, to get these conversations that are behind the closed doors, yeah. Not just in front of the camera, not just a performative, combative interview setting or a meet the press kind of a moment, because that kind of access journalism is really part of the way that we got here, I hate to say. And, I think I'm sympathetic to all the problems, structural problems that make it so that, you're like, I guess we're going to invite Sam Nunberg on Meet the Press this weekend to talk about it. But at the same time, I think, as documentary filmmakers, we can flex our muscle, which is outside of that system,
yeah,
and
we have
make
a
something.
Privileged, yeah. We're in a privileged position. We have a luxury that journalists don't have.
I mentioned earlier that despite his attempts to be ingratiating, he doesn't always seem to have much respect for the people who work for him. We see him really complaining about some staffer in... Oh.
I worked for him for three years. That was nothing.
He complains about some staffer in London as a jerk. And then at one point, after seething about one of his underlings over the phone, he seems to promote his young nephew to take charge of a project on a whim.
Yeah, I mean,
he's very erratic. I would say it's one of the very notable things about him. He has a very explosive temper. He's very impulsive, and I think when you see right in that moment of him promoting his nephew Sean Bannon, I think what you see is, in fact, he's not this strategic genius who has a large organizational chart, is plotting things. He's a guy that responds in the moment, makes certain decisions. Frankly, when he was running my company, that were very damaging because they were impulsive and they were driven by temper and by reactivity. So when you see him promote Sean, I think that goes far to kind of dispel the notion that he is this sort of mastermind, pulling strings, when you see that this is actually how he operates. And that is very much how he works.
How aware is he of the image that he presents? One person remarks on the fact, is asked him, do you always wear a shirt over your shirt? He tends to walk, even go to fancy meetings in baggy pants of one sort or another. So he must be aware of the fact that he's presenting a certain kind of image of himself.
I think that's one of the reasons he is actually a good character to follow for a film, and what makes the film engaging is that he has this weird mix of self-awareness and a total lack of self-awareness.
Yeah.
And I think that's why he's able to expose himself, just by me sitting back, he's often exposing himself. And at the same time, he is able to sometimes see himself from the outside and make self-deprecating jokes. And a lot of people are surprised that he, in the movie, you are sometimes laughing with him when he's cracking jokes about himself. And then there are other times where you're like, don't you know how this sounds? Or why do you look like that? Or why would you say that in front of the camera? And again, I don't think it's that he's such a mastermind that everything is calibrated for my camera. I was there for a long time. I captured hundreds of hours, and this is all a distillation of my experience of him.
And he's savvy, right? Having that look, being known as a slob, dressing like that—it's part of marketing, right? He's so easily recognizable. It's iconic. Mm-hmm. He doesn't look like any other political figure.
He's not a hustler. He's just a regular guy. Yeah. Doesn't the title of your film come from an Abraham Lincoln quote about America on the brink of destruction? Do you really believe that's the message of this film?
Well, I think that the message of the film is that it's about this time. I think it's not just about, a character study of Bannon. But I think Bannon is a creature that thrives on the brink. People talk about the swamp and creatures of the swamp. I think all of us as citizens feel like we are constantly on the brink, and are we being held back from it, or are we going from brink to brink to brink? And I think we have to be wary, because I think figures like Bannon, who have no moral bottom and who are willing to do or say anything, are the ones who are going to succeed in these moments if they aren't encountered by opposition in a successful way.
I've been speaking with Allison Clayman and Marie-Therese Gerges about their film, The Brink, which opens at this Friday at the IFC Center in Greenwich Village and then uptown at the Landmark 57 West. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having us.
And that brings us to the end of today's show. My great thanks to Allison Clayman and Marie-Therese Gerges, to Charlie Morrow, who composed our theme music, to Reggie Johnson, who is at the audio controls, and to my executive producer, Jesse Lent. Blended Lopate at Large comes to you on Saturdays at 4 and Tuesdays at noon. You can subscribe to Blended Lopate at Large podcast on iTunes and by clicking on Robin Hood Radio's archive program site, which is robinhoodradio.com. You can also check out Blended Lopate at Large Facebook page. We hope to see you next week.